What is the biggest obstacle you've had to overcome to be the leader that you are? How did you do it? So, Rick Holland, why don't you go ahead and answer that first?
Pride.
Okay.
Pride. And that's okay. The being too proud to lead sometimes because I know it will cost me, and too proud as a leader and trying to flex that muscle or whatever. And pride makes you lazy. I think that for me, that's the disease that infects my leadership more than anything else.
Now, maybe how did you stumble upon it? Because I know with me, I think I'm the most humble person on earth.
We all see that, Dave.
Yeah. How did that come to your attention?
Good friends who said, this one guy I remember saying to me over and over, I don't know what's in your heart, but this is what it sounds like. And secondly, I have a wife who is the woman thou gavest me. Mm-hmm. You know, she just is penetrating and seeing and helping me recognize things in my heart that are. My best advice for myself is to listen to my wife's recognition of expressions of pride, because my pride usually is the first thing to defend my pride. Mm-hmm. Well, of course I wasn't pride. Well, that's proud. Mm-hmm. So, but it is that, yeah.
Yeah.
And pride.
How about you, Craig?
I tend to suffer from a disease called the paralysis of analysis.
Uh-huh.
And that keeps me from making decisions as effectively as I should. And Rick talked about the role of decision-making in leadership. I don't make decisions quickly, and sometimes that robs me of effectiveness as a leader in every setting. So another is that I tend to be pretty introverted and academic. Mm-hmm. I don't naturally engage well with large groups. It's difficult for me, and that's
so. Is this kind of a challenge for you right now?
No. Yeah, I'm looking at you and not at them.
Okay, there you go.
But you've got a great looking sweater and shirt combination there. I like that.
The rest of the guys didn't get the email, but we did.
All right, Craig, just right here. Go on.
So those two things.
Okay. How about you, Rick?
I'm proud to say I don't have a problem with pride. No, mine was arrogance. When I started off, I really enjoyed being the person people came to. And so I had to work through that. I worked through that primarily by being a youth pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And planned all kinds of stuff, things like that, nobody'd show. So God really kind of, those years in Louisiana, just took me through the ringer with regard to that. But kind of ministry, I really wanted people to notice me and come to me and desired that. And that arrogance really had to be worked through.
Okay. How about you, Brett?
Pride, arrogance, introvertedness, all of that, as it just keeps coming down here, yeah. I started in ministry too young, right out of high school, 18 years old, started serving with a pastor who had planted churches for 50 years, which was helpful because I needed someone like him to knock me down because I thought I knew pretty much everything there was to know about ministry. You know, I'd been saved for at least 4 years, so that was good. Then he did help me out with that. He was very brutal with me, but then he died, and the church called me as pastor, and I took it on, and the church immediately grew very quickly, and so I got even more prideful. It was as if God was teeing me up, and then conflict came, and my arrogance kicked in because I was doing it all right. And it all fell apart. And it fell apart in disastrous ways, personally and otherwise. So it became painful at that time. Reoriented my life to focus more on developing people and not me. Mm-hmm. And not my ministry, but focus on people.
How about you, Jack?
Let's see here. A little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. I'm Irish. I think that's probably my biggest problem.
Yeah.
I just want to pull out my Glock and...
Yeah.
I think when I look back, I didn't have... You know, I grew up in a pagan family, never went to church, so I didn't have a good role model. That was one thing that I think... Not as an excuse, but just, you know, I just didn't have that. And so being in the ministry, God has just sent trials. Trials when, just a whole variety of them, but I would say when you kind of get to the end of yourself, sometimes I felt like it was like me, Jesus, and me and Jesus. I mean, that was it. Like everybody's against you, trials, persecution, death threats, all of these things I think just have a way of kind of beating you down and, you know, humbling you over the time. And so you get over yourself and or at least a little bit more over yourself. I don't think you ever get over completely, but I'm still way in process, so I haven't gotten there. So I can't answer the last part yet, except that I'm just moving in the direction.
Yeah, it's kind of like scaling mountain ranges where you cross one ridge and then you see another one. And yeah. So based on, I'm doing family questions here. These are two young men who obviously wrote this. I'll ask them both, and then you guys can weigh in on them. Based upon your experiences, what advice would you give to a man beginning a marriage in how to lead his wife? And then the second question is, I'm the youngest of my family, and plus an expecting father. Somehow, I am the head of the family. Now I have a lot of responsibility. How do I handle my family and extended family? So, because what counsel would you give to a young father, expectant husband, about where to begin? I mean, look back at your own life. What do you wish somebody would have told you? Okay. Brett, go ahead.
Oh, he bails me out.
Yeah.
I wish I would have had somebody connect me more with another mature Christian couple who would have walked with me closely through those times, especially, you know, in the beginning of marriage and even in parenting. One of the things I love about our elders and I love about our church is constantly being able to go to them as a resource, not trying to do all that on my own. I think that's part of the body life of the church is a greater connection. I would hope that they would be very open and honest with a strong Bible-centered Christian couple that would help them in that area.
Other thoughts? Craig, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the most important... I have five children, ages 30 to 20, and one of the most important things that we did over the years, and this is very general, and it's easy for me to say this, I suppose, as a pastor, is that we immersed ourselves from the time we were married until today in the life of our local church. And that became the venue in which we grew close to one another as man and woman and in which we raised our children. And I don't think that sounds perhaps overly simplified, and yet I don't think I could underestimate the significance of your local church in helping you train your family and helping you lead it.
Yeah, Brett, you actually shared some good insight on that in your talk, in your breakout session about... I guess the fallacy of seeing yourself as the priest. You want to maybe comment on that and share that with some people who weren't in the breakout session?
I mean, it's a regular thing. I was dealing with it even recently with a young man who's going to get married and his soon-to-be father-in-law really sees himself as the only valid teacher to teach his daughter and the only valid teacher to teach and doesn't really even see the value of a local church or even I'm going to have to go through a personal interview to see if I'm worthy enough to have influence in their life. And I think it goes back to something that Craig's hitting at there. We have a tendency, especially young and starting out, to isolate ourselves. We need to immerse ourselves more and be much, much more open to the community that God has put around us in the church. And I don't think that we are, God didn't make us the priest. We're not intermediaries necessarily. We're not the formalized pastor. We're not the know-it-all. We need the other gifts of the body involved in our life. And I mean, that's a multifaceted question. There's so much involved in that. I would want people who have lived out the Christian life significantly in a local context to have influence in me.
I would say that I think today we have a real lack of teaching, if not even a false teaching, of true ecclesiology. And we replaced that with the idol of the family. And even in our own churches where we teach gospel, 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 we forget to teach the doctrine of the church, and we've sold ourselves short because we've become so gospel-oriented. It's not wrong, but we've done it to the fallacy and to the not teaching true ecclesiology. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I think a lot of our families are suffering. Mm-hmm. We're putting too much pressure on them where the church should be coming around and helping. And we're kind of putting everybody out there, hit their Sunday morning, maybe hit a small group, we're all good. Mm-hmm. And then it's up to you and the family. And no, it's really up to us as a church community with the gifts and all those things. I really think that that's something that's really fallen to the wayside the last 10 or 15 years in the church. And I think the church follows the tide mm-hmm. of the trend, and so we have stopped teaching ecclesiology like we should. Mm-hmm. And I think it's hurting. I think it's hurting us all. And I think part of that is men don't know how to lead because they're not connected to a church. There's an example of leading. And as a result of that, they're not leading their homes. There's, mm-hmm. there's part of it where we as men, you know, walk on our wives, take them by the hand and say, follow me. Mm-hmm. And we say it lovingly and graciously, but we say it firmly. And mm-hmm. we are so worried about being kind and gracious and loving and all these other things for wives, all those things you need to be. But there comes a point where you take them by the hand and you say, follow me. Mm-hmm. And I, honestly, some of our wives will have a hard time with that because the culture has not. We've developed a partnership mentality. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying don't do a diaper, you know. Don't do a dirty diaper, but don't do a diaper, you know. But, you know, we'll do those things, but we have taken on the servant leadership so much we stopped leading. Mm-hmm. We've just become servants. And there's that balance there, but we don't see that so much in the church either. And I think sometimes we need to walk into our lives and say, this is where we're going. And, you know, God has made me the leader. And even if we don't see eye to eye on this, this is the decision. Here we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of a follow-up on that. Let me see if I can find this question that fits in perfectly. I mean, what would you say? This is a question here. How does a quote-unquote submissive husband who has allowed his wife to be the leader in the relationship from day one change these roles in a godly way? I think that's a good question.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think, first of all, you walk in and you say, I have something to confess. And I have abdicated my role before God and before you. Mm-hmm. And I have made some really bad errors, and I have allowed you to lead. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be an adjustment. We have to work through it. But I have determined before God and my responsibility for him to love you through this process, and I'm going to begin to go mm-hmm. and back that up. And that's going to, depending on the relationship you have with your wife and how strong she may or may not be, she'll either be saying hallelujah on the one hand, or she'll be like, let's drop the gloves. Okay. Right? It's going to be one of the two, but I think you're going to have to do that.
Jack, what would you do? What would you say?
Well, I think that the same answer for like getting married or even a situation like that is you always start with teaching, because God's word is the power, the change agent. So, you know, if I was getting married, one of the best things I did is I just tried to memorize every Bible verse related to husbands that I could. I took parenting classes, marriage classes when I was single, because I knew someday I wanted to get married, and that helped me kind of, you know, a lot of times when we, you know, want to take a trip or go hunting or whatever, we study up, plan, and do it. But for marriage, some reason, a lot of people like to just do it and then like crash and then try to figure out after. It's always mm-hmm. easier to do beforehand. And but when you do crash and things are out of sync, I think it should start with very, very clear, regular, multiple exposures to the truth before going in the direction, so that, you know, if the Bible is the authority, then, you know, it's pretty easy to establish the roles. And I think any woman who wants to honor the Lord is going to want to come under. I mean, it's going to be pretty easy. The problem is if you have a wife who doesn't know the Lord, and you do, and she doesn't want to give up. Then it gets a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that it can seem is when you begin to, you know, do what Rick said and said, hey, this is where we're going, and she says, well, I'm not going there, it puts you in a very awkward situation. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, what do? You, if she doesn't know the Lord, you know, are you going to bring her up to the church for discipline? Well, she doesn't know the Lord. And, you know, are you just going to, like, walk off without her? You know, it's not an easy, I don't think there's a really easy answer except to try and get the gospel in her and get her saved, but only God can do that.
Any other thoughts?
I think there's a direct biblical answer to that, which is in Titus 2, this is addressed. Mm-hmm. Older women teach the younger women too, and it gives a series of things, and one of them says to be subject to their own husbands. Mm-hmm. This is not natural, and if there has to be woman-on-woman discipleship. This is supposed to be the case for... It's hard. And mm-hmm. so to finding... you were talking earlier, Jack, about you find couples in the church that, mm-hmm. to disciple you, find someone to connect with. This is one of the things that an older woman is to teach a young woman how to do, mm-hmm. is to be subject to her husband. I don't think that God designed... This goes back to what Rick said about ecclesiology. This was not designed to be fixed inside the home with a man and a woman. This requires, by biblical mandate, older, godly, experienced couples being involved with that. And I think our isolationism and our pride would probably prevent that. But that's one of the clear mandates that an older woman is supposed to teach to a younger woman is, here's how to be subject to your husband.
Yeah. Hey, kind of following up on that, this is kind of a good follow-up question, or set of questions. What if your wife absolutely refuses to follow your leadership? And you knew this question was coming, right? What wisdom do you have for a husband whose wife doesn't want to let him lead?
Titus 2.
Okay.
I mean, seriously, you involve other people. That's the biblical protocol for sin. Mm-hmm. And we look at church discipline, and I hate that term. We call the four steps of church repentance and restoration the final step of church discipline. Mm-hmm. There are three steps with multiple in-between steps that can happen before that. You involve other people. And mm-hmm. So if there's a resistance for anybody else knowing, that's pride. And ultimately, Dave, let me just go to the end game. That mm-hmm. An absolute stiff-arm refusal to obey the objective word of God may indicate that you're not a believer, and it may be mm-hmm. evangelism that you need, not marital counseling. Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe I'm sure you guys have counseled men in this situation. So a man's in your office and he's just saying, man, I've been telling my wife to do stuff and she's not doing it.
Stop the presses.
Right?
That was your problem right there.
I'm saying, so, yeah. I mean, we've all seen that situation. We might have been that guy. Okay, so what, from his angle... because obviously in the scriptures it doesn't say husbands subject your wives, but wives be subject to your husband. But maybe walk through how you would counsel a guy who perhaps there's a good reason why his wife's struggling in following his leadership.
My dad used an illustration when I was really young about it was about a baseball team, but about leadership. And he put about a 6-foot piece of a rope out, mm-hmm. and he says, I want you to put that rope over there, and I want you to keep it in a straight line. You want to push it or you want to pull it? Well, if you push it, it's just going to be a mess. Mm-hmm. And the illustration, obviously, is you go the direction and lead her that way. If you try to push her that way, most women don't want to follow their men because we're not followable. Mm-hmm. And I would look in the mirror first and say, do you want to go where I'm going rather than telling her you need to be where I want you to be? Mm-hmm. And so much of it is example. And the thing is, Dave, this issue, and all these guys can tell you, you don't solve this in an hour counseling situation. Mm-hmm. It took you years to get here. It's going to take a little more than a session to get you where you need to be. And mm-hmm. and it's consistency in pulling. And by pulling, it's I'm going to Christ. I'm following hard after him. Mm-hmm. I'm in the Word just like the King is in Deuteronomy. Come with me, not go where I think you should go. That's mm-hmm. that she's going to smell hypocrisy on that.
Mm-hmm. Helpful resource that has been shaping our church recently, that especially our elders, that we've been working through that, Instruments in the Redeemer's Hands, by Tripp, which, I mean, these are heart issues. Mm-hmm. And getting to heart issues isn't just saying that's a heart issue, and so we need to get to that. It is really learning to know that person. How do you effectively love them? I mean, there's so much involved in that. That's a helpful resource, I think, that would give you some ideas of how to shape and disciple a heart, especially one that's very resistant.
Yeah, maybe some other distinction, too, is how do you discern when the guy really wants to lead his wife versus control his wife? I mean, how do you kind of flesh that out? And kind of, I mean, is that wrong?
We all want to control our wives.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's wrong, and sometimes that's leadership. I mean, because we want to control our kids. I would love for my kids to always obey.
Uh-huh.
And so some of that is the difference between control and leadership. That's a good distinction. Mm-hmm. And it's by the power of God's sanctifying grace. We cannot change a person.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty humbling thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
If the curse of Genesis 3, like we talked about in the breakout session, is if her desire is for her husband to rule him and he's going to come back despotically, fight back. I mean, that's what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. If the gospel is the absolute remedy to that, and Ephesians 5 is the counter to the curse of submission and love, then the emphasis is just exactly how are you loving her? What's that going to look like? And how's that being driven by the gospel in your own life and your passion to see her come under the rule of the gospel, not just under your rule?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the way you determine whether, you know, you're controlling or not is ask which the tasks are. Because if it's the house is messy, the kids are a mess, and things aren't getting done, then those are tasks. Mm-hmm. But if the guy's like, my heart, you know, my wife is, I want to lead her to godliness and things like that, then you want to lead. I think a lot of us, we're men, we think of tasks. And so we come home and, you know, this level, that level, this level, this level, and those things are there. Or she's not agreeing with me, right? Those tend to be the task issues versus I'd love to lead my wife, you know, and I'd love to pray with her. I'd love to do all those things. And you're like, okay, this guy really wants to lead his wife and not just control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here's two interesting questions kind of following up. How do you tell your wife to stop listening to her mother in a gracious way? Her mother is not a believer.
I don't do that kind of thing.
And this is my favorite question here. It's a two-sider, okay?
Let's close in prayer.
Two-sided. If you wrote this question, don't raise your hand, okay? We won't know who you are. How can I lovingly lead my wife in the area of food and health? Over the last several years, my wife has been very concerned about the types of food we eat as a family. She's convinced that we need to eat gluten-free. I'm not convinced. She has done a lot of internet-based research on gluten-free paleo cooking, coconut oil, etc. But I'm not convinced it's effective or necessary. You probably had a really good meal today, didn't you? We won't tell your wife what you ate, by the way. My wife goes as far as to believe that sin issues can be caused by gluten in our diet. How can we keep our food and health concerns from controlling her time, energy, and focus? So, you're on. Brett, go ahead. No, or Craig, you have.
We're going with the open Bible on this one.
Craig has an open Bible. Go ahead, help us.
Trying to find where to cut the sausage. It's all good. Yeah, it's all good.
All right. As Craig's looking.
Oh, I'm there.
You're there? Okay, go ahead.
Colossians 2, chapter 2, verse 20. If you have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourselves to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish with use, in accordance with the commands and the teachings of men? These are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body. You know what comes next? But are of no value against fleshly indulgence. majoring on the wrong things.
Yeah.
I would just add there, it's very common in the world today with worldly people who don't believe in an afterlife and are scared to die, and rightly so, that living in this world, this sin-cursed world and their sin-cursed body, is their highest good. And we just need to educate our families that the highest good is dying and being with Christ. That is a better thing. And so, you know, just it's okay to exercise, and it's okay to take vitamins, and it's okay to eat reasonably well. But the point is when your mind thinks, I am fearful of dying, I am fearful of getting old, I am fearful of what is inevitable, there's a theology issue there. There's a broken thing about what is most important and what we're living for. And the fact is, if you exercise well and eat well, you're going to die. And if you don't eat well, you're going to die. And if you never exercise, you're going to die. It's appointed for men to die once. And so I think it's just, the trend of the age to be healthy and gluten-free and organic. I mean, organic stuff. Don't even get me started.
But you garden organic, don't you?
No. Okay. No. Organic food, they put nicotine sulfate, which is organic and has lots of residuals that carry on and you eat, and it's really bad for you. Other pesticides, they just break down into basic hydrocarbons in a day or two, and they're fine. So you're paying more for more toxicity when you get organic. So
somebody studied this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's another question, too. I mean, on one hand, there is the issue of really leading your family. Mm-hmm. But when you read that question, I mean, maybe give the guy some help out as far as what are some hard issues that he maybe need to start addressing in his wife, and maybe some practical strategies for where to begin.
I would, first of all, determine there's a lot of things that people eat they shouldn't. Mm-hmm. A lot of pain issues, things like that. Some of them are trendy and everybody wants to be a part of the trend. Some of them are true health issues. And so, first of all, you know, I don't eat shrimp because I'm allergic.
Okay.
Right? And if I do, you know, I die. Okay. And I realize I can die sooner or later. But, you know, my doctor lets me know that I shouldn't have too much red meat because cholesterol issues at like close to 300. And so, you know, I take a pill. There's some stewardship and wisdom here, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's an appointed time for us to die. I can't hurry it. I can't not hurry it, but the quality of my life might be different. I work out. I don't look like it. But I do, because I think there's some value to that. I feel better. So I'm not think we should poo-poo all of that. There's some wisdom and stewardship of the body God gave us and doing some of those things. I think there's clearly an overboard to all that. Mm-hmm. And you have to work through if your wife is doing it because she wants to be part of the trend, or if there's some legitimate health issues with regard to that. If you got gluten intolerance, there's some problems there, and you should be wise with regard to some of that stuff. But I think there is heart issues. I think part of that is, you know, it's trends and things like that. I'm not organic. Mm-hmm. My wife likes to do that kind of stuff, and we've kind of, you know, you eat what you eat. When you're not around, I'll eat what I eat.
Yeah.
I'm not hiding that fact from you, but the weaker sister thing, you know, the cholesterol brother thing. So,
Brett, you have anything?
I wonder what's motivating her to be that interested in it. I mean, if we have not been good stewards and we're overweight and the doctor's saying, you've got problems, and it has kicked her into this hyper gear of, we got to do something. I just wonder what's motivating it. What's driving that? Is it just that she's bought into the fad, or what is driving that? I mean, there are plenty of us who aren't caring for ourselves in a way that would honor the Lord. I can remember my wife got pretty interested in changing our diet when the doctor told me about 7 years ago, you are this close to having a stroke. I actually went to the doctor because I had two other staff guys that I was working with who were overweight, and we had an agreement because I was going to help them out with their stewardship of their bodies, that we were going to go to a doctor, and whatever that doctor said we were going to do, or we were, they would not serve on staff anymore. I mean, it was getting, I just looked at them, it's getting out of hand. And I was the guy with the problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't look like them.
Yeah.
Couldn't figure that out. But he said, you're this close to having a stroke, and went through all the blood levels. One wanted to put me on these medications, and we changed some diet things and leveled all of that out. But, you know, my wife got very concerned at that moment.
Yeah.
You know, about what was going on. So some adjustments, but...
Yeah, I think that's a good balance where you can't just rule it out and treat her like she doesn't know what she's talking about. But I think there is obviously fear... is one of the big issues. One passage I was just thinking about that you were bringing up is 1 Peter 3:5-6, where, for this is how holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves by submitting to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. You are her children if you do good, and do not fear anything that is frightening. And maybe you guys can kind of build on this. I mean, obviously women are in a very vulnerable situation. I mean, when they submit... when they get married, they agree to submit to your leadership. And, I mean, how do you help them become more comfortable with that and make it easier for them to kind of trust your leadership so they're not tempted to be fearful or they're not tempted to want to take matters into their own hands, usually for the sake of the children or something like that?
Well, submission doesn't mean a lack of collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
I collaborate with my wife on almost every major decision. Mm-hmm. And the more I do that, and we're injecting wisdom, we're talking about things, it's trust. I think she trusts me more when there's a collaboration. But I was kind of joking earlier, but there is a sense in which at the end I'm called mm-hmm. by God to bear the responsibility of the decision.
Mm-hmm.
But shepherding her through that process doesn't mean I come in and say, we're going to move, we're going to buy a car, this is the end of the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
One of you guys was talking today about the Genesis model, where it says the two shall become one and there'll be one flesh. The two becoming one is something before it's sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And it means you're one. You're a unit. You are, mm-hmm. God, you know, in creation, God made two of one. In marriage, He makes one of two. And mm-hmm. so I think there's a collaboration that has to be shepherded, which means you're a decision maker with her and for her, but she's informed by that.
Mm-hmm.
And having I know the one extreme, Dave, where you got the one guy. I had a friend, you guys know this guy who. Died at 48 of a heart attack suddenly on a golf course. Pretty good way to go, especially if you had a good mm-hmm. birdie before that. suddenly, and he left his wife. She's my next-door neighbor. She didn't know where the checkbook was. She didn't know where the life insurance was. She knew nothing. And there's a word for that. It's called irresponsibility.
Yeah.
That's not caring for your wife. So collaboration on these issues, that's not caring for the kids. I mean, it was a month of real challenges to find out what's next
mm-hmm.
with everything. Passwords that she didn't know for bank accounts and all sorts of stuff. So, you know, that's one of the things Kim and I have. We own each other's password for everything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what's going to happen today. I mean, if you slip into eternity, think of what your wife's going to do with all of this access to stuff. So I think I got way off of answering the question.
No, that's helpful. Well, that's Jack.
I would say that women, it seems like the questions here are kind of like, you know, how do we get women to submit? And really the answer is this. Work hard at loving your wife, cherishing her, living with her in an understanding way, as with a weaker vessel, grant her honor. You know, just do all those things the scriptures say. I've never had a woman come to me and say, my husband is loving me, He's cherishing me. He's granting me honor. He's living with me as a weaker vessel. He's living with you the understanding way. I'm just not following him. No, it's the guys who aren't doing that, but they want the following. And though before God, they still need to obey God. But as a leader, you should be more concerned with doing what God calls you to do, not what God calls your wife to do. And most women will willingly follow a loving husband who lives with her in an understanding way and collaborates and, you know, brings her into the picture. Yeah.
That's great. This is a really good question. I encounter this a lot. How do you lead a bitter wife because of my previous sin into reconciliation forgiveness? Let's say a guy looks at porn. His wife finds out about it. Maybe walk us through, how does he still fight that sin and maintain spiritual leadership in the relationship?
It's not going to happen quickly.
Yeah.
And so it's going to require consistent performance over a long period of time, and probably humbly reminding yourself that, you know, you are responsible for the difficulty that your wife is having with you, and use that as motivation to just continue to pursue a holy life. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think the wife needs to see you come in and say, I have a problem with porn. Typically, it never comes up until you're caught.
Yeah.
That's the sad thing. And I think you need to walk into the kitchen table, you need to grab your eye, you need to pull it out of your socket and put it on the table. You pluck your eye out. Mm-hmm. And she needs to see that done unequivocally.
Yeah.
So you're putting filters on everything, you're cutting things off, you're moving things, and you're doing that without anybody telling you, and you're making all the moves to remove that temptation and the possibility of opening that door to the best of your ability in front of her. Mm-hmm. And you do it right there. And then from then on, I'm with Craig, then the process begins. But she needs to see you literally walk in, cut your hand off, pluck your eye out, and throw it on the table. No holds barred. I deal with so many men. Well, I could put a filter on, but I can get around it. You know what? You didn't pluck your eye out.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing this. Mm-hmm. And the wives know that. Mm-hmm. They need to see a full scale, cut it all out.
Yeah.
And it begins there and then moves to then... Your trust is now on the credit card before you can build up a savings account full of trust with your wife again.
Yeah. Other thoughts on that?
You guys remember the, some of you may have read it, Russ Moore, who used to be the vice president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, wrote a really, really provocative, helpful article. You know, I think the title was, Would I Let a Man Who Struggled with Porn Marry My Daughter? Really, it's probably still online somewhere. I don't know if you guys saw that. Mm-hmm. And he used this illustration I'll never forget. He says, only if he's the Wolfman. He says, remember the old 1950s Wolfman movie where the guy knows he changes into a wolf at night. He knows he changes into this Wolfman at night, and he hates it. And so he goes to everybody and says, lock me up, chain me up, do everything possible. Protect me from you. Protect me from myself. That's what Rick's talking about. I will do anything because I'm aware of the monster inside of me. He says, if that's the kind of guy, yeah, he may be able to marry my daughter. You're not going to excise sin. There are besetting sins, right? Some guys struggle with one sin, another guy another. If your wife knows that you know your besetting sin and you are like that wolf man, you're that man, I will chain me up. Don't let me get near this. Then I think there's hope. It's all about trust. Everything you guys said is about trust. It's you can lose trust in an instant. You can't gain it in a minute.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the big mistakes men make is, I'm repentant now. You need to forgive me.
Yeah. I would add on that, just kind of what Rick's saying, is you need to humble yourself, and you need to go to your wife and say, this is what I'm planning to do. I will do whatever else you want, any restraints, any conditions you want to place upon me, I'll submit to those. Like, I don't want you working on the computer unless I'm, you know, nearby and the monitor's facing out into the living area. Mm-hmm. And you have to submit yourself to that. If you don't, she's just going to pick up on it, that it's just a ruse to try and get the heat off so you can continue on in your sin. So in that case, you have to submit yourself to whatever is going to help her trust you. And, and you know, she may say, well, I think you should do this, and I think you should do this, and okay is the answer.
Now, one kind of a follow-up question, and maybe you guys have seen this in counseling. You ever seen a woman kind of take advantage of that opportunity to seize the reins in the relationship? I mean, what do you, how do you help a man through that? Because obviously you don't want the marital roles to be reversed.
Well, and sometimes I see, yeah, that exact thing happen where a man feels like he has to go and dump all of his sin on his wife, and so she becomes this, you know, person who, how's your spiritual life doing? And I think
he becomes his priest.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And then so she's supposed to be her, and it's a really weird situation where counselor, priest, and accountability partner, and that's pressure that they don't need to have. They need to maybe be confident in the accountability partner you do have, and trust the person you're going to. But it does not need to be your wife. You do not necessarily need to go to your wife and bear your sinful, immoral soul to her, and you got to work through that. But she needs to have confidence that you are going to somebody, that it is regular, and that goes back to what Jack said. What else do you want me to do?
Yeah. Well, kind of changing gears, this is one, Craig, I'm going to focus on you with this one. We talked about employees in the workplace. What about managers, supervisors, and the owner's role? How about cell phone abuse? So if you are an overseer, you're overseeing people in your employ, and yet you see certain behaviors that are counterproductive, stealing time and stuff. How do you address that, I guess, in a godly way, if they're believers or even if they're not believers?
Well, I think a general answer I'll start out with, I was thinking before you went to the cell phone example, is that for the master or employers, a couple of things I think Scripture instructs them in is that they need to be just in their treatment of all their employees, and they need to be kind. And employees respond well to employers with those two characteristics. I'm not sure I understand as well the cell phone thing, other than just a specific example of abuse in the workplace.
Well, I would imagine what he meant is somebody who's always texting, updating. You look at their Facebook page and you see 20 updates during business hours.
At the very least, he's stealing time from the company, and you can begin to work with him on that basis. You know, and there may be other things that you could speak about as well, but at the very least, you know, he is pilfering, to use my text this morning from Titus 2, he is pilfering time from the company with his abuse of his phone. But the ethic for the employer, I think, is kindness and justice to begin with.
Other thoughts? Brett, what do you think?
Involvement in the individual's life. Again, just finding out what's motivating this, what's driving this, and I think that's just a key, getting involved in that individual's life much more significantly.
Okay. Here's one. I struggle with anger towards my wife and kids. Can you share some verses and tips to help me control my anger in my home?
Sounds like an Irish question.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jack.
Colossians 3:19, husbands, do not be embittered against your wives. It's interesting, you know, the verse before that is, wives, be subject to your husbands as is right and fitting in the Lord. Husbands, do not be, you know, embittered against your wives. And I always ask myself, why does he say that? Out of all the things that Paul could have said, he said that. I thought, that is unique, isn't it? Just, you know, I mean, he could have said a million things, but he says, don't be embittered, which tells us there is a, you know, a proclivity, a propensity to get irritated with your wife. Oftentimes this happens when men don't realize it at first, but usually you're attracted to somebody because they're different than you are. You know, you're a saver and they're a spender, and you're a cleanie and they're a messy, or vice versa, or whatever. You know, they're different. They're your opposite, and that's neat. You know, she's the Rocky theology. You know, I got my gaps and she got her gaps, and together we got no gaps. You know, type of thing. that's good theology. But what happens is you can begin to get irritated because your wife crushes the toothpaste tube from the middle instead of rolling it out from the end, like it says on the instructions. Because when she puts the toilet paper roll on, instead of making it come over the top so you can just flip it and get the toilet paper, she puts it the other way, and then it's like hard to get back in there. Little tiny things like that irritate a lot of guys, and they begin to focus on them, and they don't see the big picture, and these little bitternesses build up, and pretty soon they're so focused on the 5% that irritate them and their wife, it ruins the 95% of the things they love about her. And so I just developed this little technique for dealing with that, is when I would get irritated, being the Irish man that I am, thanks, Rick, I would just say, well, does this have any eternal significance? So when my wife wants to paint the walls pussy willow pink, that was actually the name of the paint.
Now, if it was salmon, that would be okay.
I reminded myself that this had no eternal significance, but reminded her, as the leader of my family, she was not going to paint my garage that color. So that's one of the little things I do. But just, you know, love covers a multitude of imperfections. And we need to make sure that we aren't obsessing on whatever little collection of irritations our wives have, because they're sinners and they have them. And getting in bitter against them.
Hey, this is another question. Could you speak to how we are to lead our family in an age of such worldliness, with specific reference to James 4:4? And I'll go ahead and read that. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So maybe with reference to how do you lead your family, and I'm going to kind of narrow this to just the media age, movies, music, internet. How do you lead your family and protect them from some of those influences? Maybe what grid do you have for what you watch, don't watch? Rick, yeah, you looked at me, so it's you.
You know, I try to piece by piece. I mean, we don't play only Christian music in my house.
Country's acceptable type of thing.
You know, everything in the 70s is wide open. It's good because it's my youth and I liked it.
Yes.
So everything that begins, well, up to the disco age, and then that was bad. And then, of course, hip-hop, I don't understand it, so that's bad. You know, so basically, if I like it, it's okay. It's kind of how it happens. I'm not really lying. You know, I think you have to work through and understand there's some stuff that's absolutely godless, and you got to keep that out, especially with movies and things of that nature. I think you do it. There's certain things you wouldn't show your five-year-old that you might watch, you know, a war movie later on in life, you know, that would be good and okay. So you have to kind of take into consideration where they are and what's going on with regard to your family. There's certain stuff that just, I mean, I haven't watched a sitcom, and I can't tell you. Probably since 95. I'm not kidding. I mean, I just, I kind of missed the whole Seinfeld stuff and all that kind of things like that. I personally found no value in them whatsoever. And when people have to say, yeah, I watched a sitcom, don't tell anybody, or, you know, then why are you doing? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Not that I'm perfect in any of that. There's some movies I've walked out of or watched on television, turned off, like, you know, not always making the best decisions on that stuff. But I think you got to be able to walk away from it if in mm-hmm. that case. And so I think it's you do some homework, you do the best you can, and when stuff comes in that shouldn't be there, you got to be able to walk up and say, that was a bad move. Let's walk away from that one.
Yeah. What about you, Brett?
Hard setting these, you know, hard and fast rules on media issues. I also want to intentionally ask myself, how am I trying to maximize my enjoyment of the things of the Lord, too, with them, so that we are enjoying together the things of the Lord. And the media age, too, isolates us from each other. And so in just exactly how am I engaging them in things we're doing together and outside of that media center room that we have in our home and the TV and outside and other things. What are we doing together as a family that maximizes enjoyment in the Lord and in one another where there's some conversation going on as well?
Now, Rick, I've heard you teach before about the godly ungodly entertainment and godless entertainment. And I found that distinction pretty helpful. Would you mind maybe sharing that with us?
Well yeah. I mean, not all entertainment is ungodly. It may be godless. It's kind of funny you said that. Just the other day, I was watching a documentary on World War II. There's a lot of sin in that, killing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's bad stuff, but it's what happened. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between doing that and then willfully being titillated by sin, willfully being entertained by things for which Christ died. That's a challenge. The media thing is something. I mean, that is bullseye center in where I'm living with three teenage boys. Uh-huh. I've kind of evolved is the wrong word because we're not evolutionists. Mm-hmm. I've changed in my thinking through that. We do some real stupid practical things. When we go to dinner together, everybody puts their cell phones in the middle, upside down. Mm-hmm. Nobody can look at them under the table, which they're good at. Yeah. No Twitter, no Facebook, whatever. And so there's places we control it, but I've come to love Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and everything because I'm on whatever you do to connect with your kids on those. Mm-hmm. It's really revealing of their hearts, of their friends' hearts. And the problem is not Twitter. The problem is not Facebook. Mm-hmm. Twitter has never sinned once in its life, neither has Facebook. That's the same argument with gun control. They say, you know, guns kill people. No, people use guns to kill people. And mm-hmm. The issue is here. And it's their heart. And so whether it's pornography or internet or Facebook, the problem is not there. Mm-hmm. The problem is here. And when you try to regulate this, you're missing the whole point. Mm-hmm. I can get a guy, I mean, I can go to the hospital and have acid poured in my son's eyes so they can never read another Twitter feed in their life. That's not going to change what caused that expression. Mm-hmm. And we've had, you know, situations where, you know, one of my sons has tweeted something or said something that's been inappropriate, uncouth, not cool. And it's a love-hate thing. I'm embarrassed. Mm-hmm. But I got to see something in his heart that I didn't get to see otherwise. And here's the deal. It's not going away. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not giving up. I'm just facing reality that, you know, televisions aren't going to dissolve. The internet's not going to go away, no matter how hard you pray. And Twitter and Facebook are here. Yeah. So the question is, how do they engage that love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control? Mm-hmm. And remember that those aren't things you pursue. Those are things that happen because you're pursuing the Spirit. Mm-hmm. Those are consequences. Those aren't necessarily characteristics to follow outright. They are in other passages, but not that passage. Mm-hmm. That passage is what comes out of your heart. So you got to back up and pursue the Spirit and not the flesh. So, yeah, the reality on the social media stuff. Well, we've had some battles. I mean, and I'm not sure I was right on all of them. You know, mm-hmm. you know, you can never look at Facebook as long as you live again. Mm-hmm. That was genius. You know?
Yeah.
You know, what if you die tomorrow, Dad? I mean, that's what he said. Well, yeah. I'll look at you from heaven. It's about the heart. Mm-hmm. It's about the heart. It's about the heart. And this goes back to what we talked about, I think, last year, is the wrong theology of moral innocence, that we think our kids need to be protected from everything. They're morally innocent. If we can protect them from the world, it'll be better. The world is not the problem. Your kid is. you know, you can't do anything to mess up your kid. They came that way. Yeah. And if sin is not the problem, the gospel will never be the solution. So regulating expressions where they can sin doesn't take away or deal with the heart that uses those expressions. But we still have to regulate it at some level.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'll just do one final question, kind of quick fire. As a maybe a follow-up, you know, we kind of addressed the topic of leadership. What would be one resource that you would recommend for, other than the Bible, right? Maybe a book to read, a sermon to listen to, an influential article. If you can just give them one resource to kind of follow up in this conference, what book, sermon, you name it, would you recommend?
Outside of Scripture, obviously.
Outside of Scripture, obviously, yeah. Rick?
I think Practical Religion by J.C. Ryle. Hmm. It's got how to read. It's got how to pray. I don't think you can beat it. It'll okay. make you a godly man, and then okay. you'll be a leader.
Okay.
I'd say by J.C. Ryle, Thoughts for Young Men, which is really Thoughts for Old Men, too. Hmm. It is just the same thing. Ryle's so pithy. He's British, so he says what would take us this much space in about three sentences. And Thoughts for Young Men is just really good to launch your life in the right trajectory.
Mm-hmm. That might be a good book to go through with your sons or something like that, too.
Yeah.
Craig?
I'm pretty shallow. My favorite book is always the last one I just read, you know. But a book that you gave away today, Dave, Spiritual Leadership, mm-hmm. which is not simply for pastors mm-hmm. or small group leaders. It's a great book.
Okay. Brett?
I was encouraged you were giving away Spiritual Leadership. I've read that in the past many different times and kind of fallen off my radar. And so I was telling guys here at the table that that's a great one to get. I'm kind of like, I hate that question, what's the best book? Because it's hard to pin that down. I already mentioned Instruments in the Redeemer's Hands. I just think that's so helpful for you thinking through interaction with other people, getting to the heart of the issues, which is everything that we've been talking about. How do you get to the heart of things and help people and change to be an instrument in Christ's hands, and you're not the Savior. And so I'm loving that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jack?
My favorite work is The Godly Man's Picture by Thomas Watson. You have to be able to read a little bit of old English. He's got some words in there you've never heard before. Mm-hmm. Things like lodestone. And you look it up, it's like, oh, that's a magnet. Things like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is my favorite book in that category.
Yeah, I'll bring up one book that I read as far as modern books. Al Mohler's book, Conviction to Lead. We wanted to give that away, but it was too expensive. But I thought that was a really good, comprehensive book on leadership. So let's go ahead and thank the panel for ministry to us.